Ashikta magam gandodai.
Ashikta magam gandodai.
Harinam marashikarai.
Harinam marashikarai.
Swaminam praptam aloka.
Swaminam praptam aloka.
Atamba sutaram miva.
Atamba sutaram miva.
Translation and commentary by His Divine Grace, Srila Prabhupada. During the reign of Ramachandra, the streets of the capital, Ayodhya, were sprinkled with perfumed water and drops of perfumed liquor, thrown about by elephants from their trunks. When the citizens saw the Lord personally supervising the affairs of the city in such opulence, they appreciated this opulence very much. We have simply heard about the opulence of Ram Raj during the reign of Lord Ramachandra. Now, here is one example of the opulence of Lord Ram's kingdom. The streets of Ayodhya were not only cleaned, but also sprinkled with perfumed water and drops of perfumed liquor, which were distributed by elephants through their trunks. There was no need of sprinkling machines, for the elephant has a natural ability to suck water through its trunk and again throw it out in a shower. We can understand the opulence of the city from this one example. It was actually sprinkled with perfumed water. Moreover, the citizens had the opportunity to see the Lord personally supervising the affairs of the state. He was not a sleeping monarch. We can understand from his activities in sending his brothers to see to affairs outside the capital and punish anyone who did not obey the emperor's orders. This is called Digvijay. The citizens were all given facilities for peaceful life, and they were also qualified with appropriate attributes according to Vana Ashrama. As we have seen from the previous chapter, Vana Ashrama Gunanvita, the citizens were trained according to the Vana Ashrama system. A class of men were Brahmanas, a class of men were Kshatriyas, a class were Vaishyas, and a class were Sudras. Without this scientific division, there can be no question of good citizenship. The king, being magnanimous and perfect in his duty, performed many sacrifices and treated the citizens as his sons, and the citizens, being trained in the Vanashram system, were obedient and perfectly ordered. The entire monarchy was so opulent and peaceful that the government was even able to sprinkle the street with perfumed water. What to speak of other management. Since the city was sprinkled with perfumed water, we can simply imagine how opulent it was in other respects. Why should the citizens not have felt happy during the reign of Lord Ramachandra? So we are gathered today on a very auspicious day, Sri Ram Nomi, the appearance day of one of Krishna's principal avatars, Lord Ramachandra. Ete chamsa kalopumsha kushmashtu bhagavan shwayam indriya vyakalam lokam vidayute juge juge. All the above mentioned incarnations are either plenary portions or portions of the plenary portions. It's a tongue twister. But Krishna is the original personality of Godhead. All of them, all these incarnations, appear in the material creation whenever there is a disturbance created by the enemies of Indra, the Asuras. So Krishna is Avatari. He is the fountainhead. He is the source of all incarnations who come from time to time to enliven the devotees, to annihilate the miscreants, and to reestablish the principles of dharma or religion. Actually, these incarnations are as numerous, Bhagavatam describes, as waves on the ocean. If you go down to the beach in Brighton, right, in Brighton, and you sit on the seashore, you cannot count how many waves are coming in. Practically endless. So same with the incarnation. To serve the Lord's purposes in this world, incarnations have been coming since the beginning of creation, and they will continue ad infinitum. Bhagavatam gives us the principal incarnations, of which there are 10. And of those incarnations, we know that Lord Ramachandra is one of the more prominent incarnations. And they're very much a favorite in the International Society for Krishna Consciousness, as Prabhupada demonstrated by installing Sita, Ram, Lakshman, Hanuman deities in our centers, in some temples, not everywhere, but we are graced here in the UK, in the United Kingdom, in Britain, with a beautiful set of Sita, Ram, Lakshman, Hanuman deities at our beloved Bhaktivedanta manor. So, in this verse, we hear some of the glories of Lord Ramachandra. What can one say? We hear from the Bhagavatam that Anantashesha is constantly singing the glories of the Lord by chanting his various names, because the names of the Lord indicate a particular quality, characteristic, or in many cases, a pastime of the Lord. And because the Lord's pastimes are infinite, Anantashesha never says the same name twice. This has been going on a long time. We often tell our guests at public lectures, God is one, but he has many names. How true that is, especially in the science of Krishna consciousness, where we have detailed information about the Lord, about his personality, about his abode, about his friends, about his pastimes. So Anantashesha is always chanting different glories of the Lord by repeating different names. Who knows when he said the name of Ram? It must have been a long time ago. Has it repeated? So the glories are unlimited when the Lord comes. But actually each incarnation has a particular mission, a particular mood, a particular methodology. Although the purpose is the same according to time, place, and circumstances, that incarnation will act accordingly. So when Ramchandra appeared amongst his many glories was the fact that he ruled over a perfect kingdom. And even today, this is famous, especially in Bharat, in India. Everyone aspires to be part of a government as it was when Lord Ram was here. Ram Raj. You hear that talk all the time. His kingdom was called Ayodhya. And there he was the perfect and ideal king. His kingship, is that a proper word? Is my dear Mani here? Kingship. I don't know. Kingship. His kingship, of course, was only one of the opulences he displayed, but a very important one indeed, as you say here. Indeed. Bhakti Chaitanya Swami. So. New Zealand, but Commonwealth. Indeed. So it was one of his more important characteristics that he was the perfect king. And how do we know that his kingdom was perfect, that his ruling was perfect? Well, Prabhupada describes in this purport that in a perfect government, all the material and spiritual necessities are supplied to the people so that they can be peaceful and happy, so that they can practice Krishna consciousness. The whole idea of organizing a perfect government is not necessarily that people can enjoy economic prosperity, which appears to be the main focus in our present day and age, so that people can enjoy the ultimate goal of life, which is sense gratification. The gladiators of Rome. Eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. Live life to the fullest, because after death there's nothing. Hedonistic philosophy. That is the leaders appeal to the people when in their campaign to become prime minister or president or whatever in a democratically elected government. They appeal to the sense gratification of the people. Their promises are all about getting jobs and getting money and enjoying life, and of course, no harm. These things are also required. But what is the ultimate purpose of life? That we hear from Vedanta Sutra. Sutra means code. The Vedas in code form, Vedanta Sutra, the opening verse, the opening statement by which everything else evolves, all the other verses evolve. Atato Brahmajanasya. Now that we've come to the human form of life, what's our business? Self-realization, Krishna consciousness. So kings, they had this responsibility, heavy responsibility, to make sure that people had the basic facilities of life. Prabhupada said, human life is not meant to be conducted like the lifestyle of cats and dogs, who scramble for a few pieces of food and a shelter. No, we're not meant to live like cats and dogs. We can live materially opulent life. Of course, there's different definitions of opulence. We would say opulence is land and cows. But anyway, so that people are not struggling for the basic necessities of life. If you have to struggle too much, it's true, you don't have time necessarily for the real business of Shravanam, Kirtanam, Vishnu, Shmaranam, Padasevanam, Archanam, Bandham, Dasyam, Sakyam, Atmanivedanam, the nine processes of devotional service. The king's responsibility was to make sure that the basic necessities of eating, sleeping, mating, and defending were available to the people to meet the demands of the body, so that in a peaceful state of mind, they could sit and chant. You know what it's like to chant when your mind is in anxiety about necessities in life. It's hard. When we're struggling so much, and life is very much a struggle nowadays, so much struggle. Struggle for existence, the human race. The only hope, your divine grace, who brings the message of Godhead. We have to struggle, but we shouldn't have to struggle unnecessarily and be in great stress and anxiety and suicidal. No. We should have what we require so that when we sit, before we go to work, before we go to school, our mind can focus with full attention on the chanting of the holy names. We can discuss without any disturbance the Harikatha, the glories of the Lord, and get a deep shamskara, impression of Krishna consciousness in our hearts. We can take prasad in a proper atmosphere. And we can associate with our family members and other devotees in a joyful way. Prabhupada said, Krishna consciousness is joyfully performed. Then we can go to school and learn, and we can work hard, and then we can come home. And in a Vaikuntha atmosphere, we can continue with the same activity. So kings, they had to do this. So life is all about balance. I was just in China, and they were talking about yin-yang. Swami, could you explain yin-yang? You know Chinese philosophy, yin-yang? Life is all about balance. Getting the material and getting the spiritual. Then you're a well-balanced individual, you're equal poised. So this is the duty of the kings. And they, to do that, they were called Raja Rishis. They were kings, but at the same time, they were saintly persons sitting on the throne. And they knew the science of achieving both material and spiritual prosperity. Saha yagna praja shishtva puru vacha praja pitaha anena prashvishyashtvam esha vishta amaduk. The Lord gives the key. He gives it's an open secret, how you can be materially prosperous and how you can be spiritually prosperous at the same time. What is that? Lord says in the immortal words of his Gita, which means song, in the beginning of creation, the Lord of all creatures, sent forth generations of men and demigods, along with sacrifice for Vishnu, Yajnavai Vishnu, and bless them by saying, be thou happy, people of this earth, past, present, and future. Be thou happy by this yajna, by this sacrifice, because its performance will bestow upon you everything desirable for living happily and achieving liberation. For living happily means you have enough food on the table, you have butter, you have jam, you have all those things. And achieving liberation, the balance. So King, he knew this science of yajna, yajna by Vishnu. We've discussed many times, what does yajna essentially mean? It's a form of expressing our gratitude to God. We have the mantras, svaha, from Vedas. We have so many mantras. What is it? What is the essence? A philosopher always looks beyond the rules and the regulations and the ceremony. What is the essence of this procedure? It's to thank God for providing us these necessities, because where do they come from? They don't necessarily come from the supermarket. Nityo nityanam chaitanas chaitanam ekobahanam yovadidati kamam. In Sveta Svatara Upanishad, the Dharma Shastras, actually, like Manu Samhita, especially Atharva Veda, they deal with how the king should rule. How, it's not some made up thing like democracy or socialism or communism. These things don't really work so well. Maybe some are better than others, but whatever the Lord gives us, that is perfect. So Veda, which originally comes from the Lord, also provides a system of government. What? I thought it was all about philosophy and the soul, the super soul, the Vaikuntha. No! Dharma Veda talks about ruling over citizens, how to exempt taxes, how to deal with conflict in your kingdom, how to fight a war, how to mint money. These are things that princes, the young boys, they would study from the age of 5 to 25. And then when daddy died, when the king would die, then the prince would take over. These things, they are studied by princes. They are studied by Kshatriyas. Prabhupada mentions the Varnashrama, how important it is. And how these different Varnas in society make up the complete social body. The Brahmanas are like the head. They give direction to society. The Kshatriyas are like the arms. If there's a fight, you protect yourself with your arms. Or you become aggressive with your arms. Sometimes violence is required to protect the innocent members of society. Vaishyas are like the waist, the tummy, because they work the fields and milk the cows. And the Sudras are like the feet. They provide the basic necessities of life. So human society generally falls into these main categories, but nowadays, because it's Kali Yuga, most people are Sudras. There's no real direction. There's no protecting Dharma. There's no good food. It's all canned, boxed, mainly unmentionable items to eat. So everything is topsy-turvy. But Kshatriyas played an important role. They were powerful men who ruled society. You have to be, if you want to be a ruler, you can't be a sissy. You have to be a little bit Suryam Tejo Pritir Daksham Yude Chapya Palayanam. Heroism, power, determination, resourcefulness, courage in battle, generosity, and leadership are the natural qualities of work for Kshatriyas. You look at our leaders today, do they embody these qualities which are necessary? Heroism, power, determination, resourcefulness, leading the charge in the battle. Right? Did our Prime Minister go to the Falkland Islands some years ago and fight to defend our territory? No, he was emailing up here. Do it like this. Generosity, leadership. So kings had these qualities, but even then, because they were working in the mode of passion, because Like Prabhupada said, you never see a picture of Arjuna on the battlefield with a bead bag.
Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna.
He had a sword. That was his duty. That's how he was purified. That was his seva to Krishna. But it was in the mode of passion, in the sense that he had to be very active. So because kings were very much involved with power, with money, with resources, they had many wives, they had many children, their ruling was overseen, or they took counsel from those in the mode of goodness. Brahmanas. Brahmanas are in the mode of goodness, or Brahmana Vaishnavas are in the mode of pure goodness, Sudhasattva. So just to kind of keep the king in check, he didn't become too proud or whatever. The Brahmanas were there to advise him, because Krishna says in the Gita, the mode of goodness is illuminating. This world works in a certain way. It's not really mysterious if you know what's going on. There are certain laws governing this material creation. Things work in a certain way. Scientists, when they make a discovery, they're just discovering how it was all set up by Krishna. It's nothing mysterious or unpredictable. It works in a certain way. There's a certain harmony to nature. And it's there in the Vedas. The Brahmanas knew this. Because their intelligence was pure. They lived a pure lifestyle. They weren't in the mode of ignorance. They weren't good. So intelligence, Prabhupada says, means to see things in the proper perspective. So Brahmanas, being in the mode of goodness, being very intelligent, they could see everything was working and they could advise the king like that. And every king took humble direction from the Brahmanas. Like Chanaka Pandit, he's very famous, our Chanaka. Even now in India, there's statues, there's roads, there's buildings named after Chanaka Pandit. He gave us the Niti Shastra, basically the Shastra of logic. What's the best way to live within the laws of material nature? Again, so you can become a Vaishnava and become Krishna conscious. If you read this Niti Shastra, you go, wow, that's so simple, but it makes so much sense. Niti Shastra. And Prabhupada used to quote Niti Shastra as well. So a king always had a council of Brahmins to help, and their knowledge was there providing. And as a result, he could give them people practical advice, and he could give them spiritual advice. And thus, he was a real leader. What is a real leader? What's the definition of a leader? Guru nasasyat svajano nasasyat. Pita na sa svaj, janani na sa syat. No one should become a spiritual master, a father, a husband, a mother, a king, or a worshipable demigod unless one can deliver one's dependence from the repetition of birth and death. You shouldn't take responsibility for someone else unless you yourself are strongly situated in Krishna consciousness. You shouldn't become a demigod. You shouldn't become a guru. You shouldn't become a king. You shouldn't become a teacher. You shouldn't even become a mom or dad unless you're sure and certain that in this lifetime your child will at least have the opportunity to go back home, back to Godhead. So the king, being a leader, he had to be Krishna conscious. And with the help of the Brahmins, he would rule. How can one be a king, how can one be a leader and govern without being conversant with the laws of God as described by the Brahmanas? The laws of God, the material world, are not arbitrary laws created by mundane politicians, but rather they're absolute laws, like the law of karma. Law of karma, it's a law of nature. It's a very subtle, it's not a spiritual thing. Someone asked me, could you speak about the spirituality of karma the other day? One student. Swamiji, speak about the spirituality of our philosophy of karma in India. I said, I'm sorry. It's not spiritual. What do you mean? It's in our Bhagavad Gita. I said, it's not, karma is not spiritual. It's a subtle law of nature, which says that for every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. And you get entangled in material world. It's not spiritual. It's a subtle law of nature. He said, well, if it's subtle, if it's a law of nature, why don't the scientists know about it? I said, do you think the scientists know everything? Well, they know a lot. Well, I said, they're like the ant in the corner of the room. The ant knows a lot about 1 inch away. You've got a clue what's going on over here, me giving a talk, are you listening? What can the scientists know? They're so limited. Their minds are limited, their senses are limited, they can only see so far in the atom or out into the universe, their telescopes. So, but they may one day discover this law of karma. If it's a law of nature, maybe one day they will discover. So kings had to be conversant with the laws of nature to rule the people. Nowadays, people want a secular government, which means that they separate the church from the state. They don't want the church, they don't want the priests, they don't want the brahmanas to get involved anymore. They just want to rule without that. Like in France, ni maître ni dieu. No master, no god. We will rule the Republic of France with our fertile brains. So, we know why they want this, because of the atrocities of the church involved in politics through the last centuries. The Prabhupada said the misuse of something doesn't mean the original thing is wrong. So it's not that politics are meant to be separated from spiritual affairs. How can you rule this in this world without taking into consideration the laws that are established by God, which govern more than your puny little kingdom or country, which rule the entire creation? If you don't know those laws of nature, you'll break those laws no matter how good a prime minister, president, things are going to fall apart. You have to consider the laws of God and how this world is functioning. So spiritual leaders have to be involved in politics to a certain degree. People won't accept that. It's too recent how the church has abused this principle. Or in India, the Brahmins also abused this principle, not only in the West. But in an ideal kingdom, we see that the king was Raja Rishi. He was a king and he was a Rishi. He knew all these things and he would adjust. He wouldn't allow meat eating. He wouldn't allow people to suffer the heavy karma that is incurred by animal slaughter. Prabhupada actually says in the Bhagavatam, in one purport, that we can attribute both World War I and World War II to the unnecessary slaughter of so many cows previous to the wars. Now some politician reads that, some sociologist says, what are you talking about? That World War I and World War II was caused by, Nazi Germany, Hitler. I'm sorry, sir. According to our philosophy, Hitler was simply an agent. Of course, he was a person. He had his karma. But he was the agent who was delivering the karmic reaction of the people for the inauspicious activities performed in this life and previous lives. They may not like that. They may not accept that. But that is a fact, because Prabhupada said so. When we were kids, we used to sing, Jesus loves me, this I know, because the Bible tells me so. Jesus loves me, this I know, because the Bible tells me so. It's the Word of God, it's absolute. So Prabhupada was saying, these things cannot go on unpunished. A sinful act, it may not manifest, the reaction may not manifest in me. It may manifest in many lifetimes, but it will. Someone said, how can we be, one boy said to me, same boy, how can we be held accountable for something we did in previous lifetimes? Swami, got you there. I said, well, did you hear about the atrocities that the Nazis committed to the Jews in World War II? He said, I am Jewish. I said, so if we catch one Nazi criminal who persecuted your people in Auschwitz in 1943, should I let him go? No, you should. And he caught himself. Oh, yeah, right. I said, that was committed 60 years ago. The guy's 96. You want to let him off for good behavior? No, he should be hung by the neck. So, what's the difference? Time is not taken into consideration. The crime may have been committed, you know, last month, and we're all for getting the guy to justice. But if it happened 50 years ago, is it any less serious? Should it not be taken into account? No, it should. So I convinced him by that argument. Not me, but our Vedic philosophy. He said, "You Hare Krishnas, you have an answer for everything. You should read our books. It's fun. Digby Jah, you can't be defeated." So the king, he had to be conversant with these things. So being conversant with Dharma Shastra, which says that the innocent members of society should never be exploited but should always be protected, we don't kill animals. There's different innocent members of society who cannot necessarily defend themselves but have the right to live, have the right to live a natural duration of life, and especially become Krishna conscious, like animals. They can't become Krishna conscious, but animals, children, women, ladies, and old men. Before, I wasn't part of the category. A lady had to protect him. Now I'm old, so I have to hold it. And brahmanas. Yeah, brahmanas. So animals, they have their place. They're useful in many ways. And a life based on simplicity, simple living with high thinking. Transportation, you don't need all these rules governing the fumes and the petrol as you have here in London. On certain days, these cars can come in, these guys all come. Any more complicated, you just, you know, you come in on the horse. And the oxen, and it's never. So, yes, the kings, they had this. They had to be familiar with no meat eating, they wouldn't allow intoxication. There was some intoxication, there was some wine, of course, but not to the degree that we have today. Some things were regulated so that people regulated intoxication. The higher classes didn't partake in intoxication, but others were allowed to, it was their nature, but in a regulated, restricted way, and by associating with higher class people, they gave the bad habit up. That's the idea. There were even prostitutes. What? That's illicit sex. But there were prostitutes, and probably the reason there were prostitutes, and the prostitutes were sometimes devotees of Krishna. What? Yes, because Prabhupada said there are men who are unscrupulous, they're not satisfied in their relationship with their wife at home, and they go out and they engage in these activities with young girls, pollute society in this way. So Prabhupada said, if they're not satisfied, then they would go to the brothel. And that young girls would be protected. It was an adjustment. It's not perfection, but a way of adjusting that desire in such a way that society could maintain order as best you can in this world. And there was also animals killing, but the Kshatriyas would go into the forest and the sadhus were meditating there, and sometimes they would be eaten by tigers. When the tiger population got very big, there wasn't enough deer to go around, so even that skinny little scrawny yogi looked like a good meal. So the Kshatriyas would go and they would improve their fighting skills by shooting animals, because you have to practice. Practice makes. We can't go to the battlefield and start, you know, like, how far do I pull the bow back? You have to practice, just like Arjuna Dayal. He's always practicing. Always in some fighting mood. Actually, he's a humble Brahmin, but for service, he acts like Kshatriya, and he's always taking the right food substances. And he was a skinny little scrawny guy, and now he looks like, you know, Mr. Atlas or something. But he's not attached, it's just a service, and he has to practice and lift the weights and run every day for seva, for service. Because on the stage, people like it, and then they have some faith in this culture, and then I come on and give the lecture, and I really give it to them. But they're ready to hear who has a purpose. So Kshatriyas, they had to fight all the time. A boxer's practicing every day, 4, 5, 6 hours every day. Sugar Ray Robinson, he was one of probably the best boxer ever known. He was middle light, middleweight, bracket, but probably the best boxer ever known, Sugar Ray Robinson, America. And he would practice 6 hours every day boxing. Take a little less on Sunday. Practice, practice. Practice makes perfect. So Kshatriyas, so they'd shoot the animals. So these things were there, but in a controlled, not uncontrolled, unregulated sense gratification as we have now. People can't all be sannyasis and renounce sense gratification totally. Even sannyasis have their Mac computers. They prefer it over PC. One time Ramana Swami told me, he said, after going from a PC to a Mac, he said, going back would be like illicit sex. Going back to a PC. After having a Mac, you just wouldn't downgrade like that. So by having these things, but getting the higher taste of Krishna consciousness, even the sutras could become Brahman. As bell metal is changed into gold by a mystical process, so a low-born, fallen, sinful man can become a Pakka Brahman Vaishnava by proper training, association, and diksha, initiation into the Vaishnava cult. It wasn't that the Brahmanas, Prabhupada said the duty of a first-class man is to make a fifth-class man a first-class man. That was Brahman, in not the modern concept of, the social classes they have in India. But that, even a low-class man, if he so desired, could be elevated. Otherwise, how can we believe in the power of God? If God cannot elevate one from a fallen condition, then what is the power of God? God's power must be absolute. So through these ways, even a low man could be. So the king knew this, and he knew that, again, that prosperity was not just the sweat of your brow and setting up industry, but that through performance of yajna, these things would come, and they would be acknowledged to the yajna. He would tax the people. Taxes are not bad, but he would use the taxes to buy ghee and lots of grains and pay the Brahmins. And if there's yajna going on, everyone benefits. Prabhupada said if only 1% of the population became Krishna conscious, the whole atmosphere would change. To live the right life, even in this wrong world, means that other things would. So governments have to make sure that they're doing the taxes and they're protecting the people and they're building the roads and digging the wells, all things governments should do. But they should make sure that whatever the yogi is for that age, it's being funded, it's being facilitated by the government. The government has extra money because they tax the people unless they put it in their pockets. And with that money, lots of times that's how culture develops. You can't have the buildings like you have in London or in your country. You can't have the history you have unless you had kings who taxed the people and gave the money to the artists to paint the paintings and make the statues and build the buildings and pay the musicians and so forth like that. That's how culture is an opulence. It's an extra. It's not a necessity, but it's all the kings had to tax the people and use that money to make British culture, to make Indian culture, to make Chinese culture. Where did it all come from? The king supported it. Think the people have that kind of money? So that's there, but the kings also had to make sure that the yajna was going. They had to attend with their wives and sit as the Brahmanas chanted. And they should also go on Harinam on Oxford Street. We should go to 10 Downing Street, knock on the door and say, Prime Minister, time for Harinam. Parsaram's waiting. Govinda's got his accordion today, so Saturday night, Prime Minister. We laugh, but that's actually how it should be. They should, if not that, then they should pay for, the books to be distributed, they should pay for the prasadam to be distributed, they should provide facilities like this all over the city. Not just one, but in every area of London, there should be a beautiful temple with beautiful deities where people can come and become purified, because it's hard for us to maintain these things. We're Brahmanas. we're trained to be brahmanas, we're not even vaishyas, we just barely pay the bills. The brahmana should be free to preach. That's as important as anything else. The brahmanas should be there to remind the people of the goal of life and how to achieve it. They shouldn't have to worry about making money. They shouldn't worry about management. They shouldn't worry about the crops. They should just be out there preaching. They should be maintained. That's why brahmanas were maintained, so they could preach. And therefore they always had a bit of the belly. A typical Brahmin in a Vedic painting, he's got big, big belly. Because he's sitting all day and getting the offerings. He gets all the maha, so his brain is nourished, so he can give the good philosophy. So you don't see Brahmin as, you know, mean, mean fighting machine. In my country, the physique, everyone desires, what do they call it, a six-pack? You know, you have these muscles on your abdomen, you know, and you're a lean, mean fighting machine. India, they preferred little belly. This means you were opulent, you were well-to-do. Like in Western culture now, they all want the thin women. You see the models? I was on the flight, and there was a group of models. And I said to someone, I said, are they eating properly? I said, what? Don't you? Where are you from? I said, they look pretty thin. He said, they're models. They're beautiful. That's beautiful. They were like really thin. I said, in African culture, the African people, they live in mostly in austere conditions. So they want to marry a girl who's successful, and one sign that she's successful is she's quite big. You know, she doesn't. They're thin by destiny. They don't have enough to eat, but when the African people eat, they get quite big. So the African men, they were telling the Zulu men, they were sitting, we were doing food distribution, and these big mamas went by. And they were saying, oh, look how beautiful. And he said, I'd like that one as my wife, and that one. Standard. Because real beauty is Krishna consciousness. We don't make a distinction ourselves. If one is Krishna conscious, they have it. They manifest all the good qualities of the soul, and that is real. But it was interesting. So brahmanas there, isn't it? Just busy giving, giving good instruction like that. So the kings had to ensure all these things were happening. Prabhupada mentions one last point here that there was no sinful activity going on. The body, the social body is some social. The society is sometimes compared to a social body. If the body is sick, it can't function properly. So if a sick body means a society which is addicted to sinful activities, the result is they'll suffer, then the king has to make sure that sinful activities aren't going on. So Prabhupada mentions this in the purport. The king would tour the kingdom. Personally, he'd lead the charge. People would have faith. He's a strong ruler. And as in the case of Maharaj Pariksit, when he came across Kali, who wanted to kill the bull, then Maharaj Pariksit was ready to kill the offender, so they had to be like this. Nowadays you don't see kings like that. The Bhagavatam predicts the type of governments we'll have in the 12th canto. Evam prajibir dushtabir akirne shishti mandale, said that as the earth becomes crowded with corrupt population, whoever among any of the social classes shows himself to be the strongest will gain political power. Might is right. So therefore we see people who have money, they can have big political campaigns, and they get elected to power because they have good advertising. That's the situation in my country right now. Or Dashu Pradeshu Rajeshu, that's a famous quote Prabhupada used to say. In Kali Yuga, the kings will be mostly thieves. I will not comment too much because maybe there's some secret servant agent here and I'll get in trouble. Prajuhi Lubdai Rajanyayar Nigranayar Dashu Dharamabhi. That's a nice one. Losing their wives and properties to such avaricious and merciless rulers who behave no better than ordinary thieves, citizens will flee to the mountains and forests. Stay tuned for the next episode. It's not happening now, but it says in the Bhagavatam. People will become so frustrated with so-called political leaders, they'll just leave the city. They would prefer to live at the mercy of nature. And then Bhagavatam describes at the end of Kali Yuga, devotees are living underground. It becomes so hellish. So as a result of this improper ruling, the leaders often meet inauspicious deaths. Manasamhita says that a king or a queen share 1% of the sinful activities of people. They share 1% of the pious activity, and they share 1% of the sinful activity. So be careful. If you want to be elected to the government, you better make sure that the people in your kingdom are auspicious. Because then, you know, everything will come your way. If they're inauspicious, you'll get the reaction as well. Leadership is a serious responsibility. So if there's millions of people in your country, they're acting in sinful ways, then we see quite often leaders die when they're assassinated. Like, well, I don't know the history of your country, but I'm sure that there are political leaders who were assassinated. In India, I remember Indira Gandhi. My country, we have Kennedy, we have, you know, Robert Kennedy, we have Abraham Lincoln, we have, you know, they're so well protected, they share 1% of the inauspicious actions of the people. So these, you can see, that's not an easy job, to be a king, to be a prime minister, to be a president. You have to be tough, to be a Kshatriya, to be able to deal with rascals. Because Papa Prana says there's two types of people in this world, pious and impious. So if you're going to be a king, it's not going to be, you know, such an easy way. So Janakapanda says you control a bull with a ring in its nose, you control an elephant with a goad, that sharp thing behind his ear, you control a horse, what did you say, with a whip, and you control a rascal with a stick. Kings can't be sentimental. If there's murder, then they would immediately execute the person. Not, you know, nowadays they have like, there's no death penalty in many countries. Most countries there's no death penalty. It's just simply sentiment. It's actually in the interest of the murderer to be executed, because if he lives, in his next lifetime he has to have a very horrible birth living out the reactions to that murder. So if he's killed in this life, it's also in his interest. So these kings, they would fight. A Brahmana's strength is in his learning. A Kshatriya's strength is in his army. A Vaishya's strength is in his wealth. And a Sudra's strength is in his attitude of service. A Samurai's strength is his sword, his mirror, sword, his mirror. His treasury. His sword, he could fight. His treasury, he had money to fight. And his mirror, meaning he could be deceptive. So Kshatriyas had an army, they had to fight, and they would sometimes go into battle themselves. They would marry Kshatriya girls. That was the way in Vedic culture. You marry the same varna, you marry the same ashrama. So they would marry princesses, and these princesses were also trained in diplomacy, because they had to run part of the palace, because there's men and there's women. So the queen, she would be in charge very often of the various functions within the palace, organization, the kitchen, the serving, receiving guests, cleanliness, washing, you know, she would delegate responsibilities, and sometimes, if necessary, like we read how Rukmini, when Krishna rescued Rukmini and they were driving away, it was Rukmini who was, Krishna was in the back of the chariot shooting the arrows, as they got away, and she was driving the chariot. And could any of you girls get, you know, on a chariot with 12, you know, powerful horses and drive away at high speed down Oxford Street? The group meeting, she was a delicate young princess, fair, soft skin. These girls never even went outside. The skin was very soft and white, tender. She was a princess, so she took the reins, and Krishna said, "Get us down!" And Krishna's firing, "You're a good driver." There's a story that I heard when I was in Rajasthan that, you know, the Muslims, the Mughals, they came into India, and they were fighting because the Hindus were so unorganized and you know, not cooperative. There were different kingdoms, and they were not, there was no cooperation between the Hindu kings. The Muslims just overran them one by one. Had they been a unified force, they could have perhaps stopped the Muslim invasion, but it was otherwise. And one Muslim army attacked a particular fortress in Rajasthan, and the king, the Raj, Rajput, he went out with a greater portion of his army, and they fought, and they lost. But the queen, she wouldn't surrender the fort, and she still had some soldiers, like one quarter of the army or something, but they were outnumbered and surrounded, and, you know, the Muslims didn't want to necessarily attack because they would lose a lot of men, so they just kind of waited it out until they ran out of food and water. Like this. So then the Muslim ruler, he asked to meet the queen. So they met, but the girls were so chaste, especially these higher orders of society, that the queen didn't meet with him directly, but by mirror. He was able to see a reflection of her in the mirror, but she wouldn't allow his sinful eyes to fall upon her chaste form. So she was on one side of a wall, and he on the other side, but there was a mirror positioned such a way that he could see only a part of her body, not her whole body, her arm like this or something. So he knew he was talking to her. So he proposed, he was a rascal, he proposed that you come with your harem. The king had a harem, he had other queens, she was the first queen, other queens and other princesses and even other girls. They would sometimes, the king would visit other working girls. That's just, Vidura was born with one such conception. He wasn't allowed to be prince because the king had a relationship with a girl who was not of a higher order in the palace, and Vidura was born. So this harem, so that Muslim, he said, Muslim king, he said, you come with your harem outside to our camp, and you let my men enjoy all of you, and then we will go away. We will leave you. We will not destroy your palace and destroy all the people here. Do you agree? Of course, no chaste woman would even think of such a thing. But she was very intelligent. She was queen. She was princess, and she had associated with her husband for so many years, and being around, and hearing the talk of the palace and observing her husband's campaigns and hearing the stories of how he would fought and all the different imagery and everything, she was trained. So she thought, she said, yes. He was shocked. You will come? Yes, we would like to preserve the lives of our citizens. So I will enjoy you. Yes. And he was like... And my lieutenant here, he'll have your daughter, yes, and you know. So you come at 5 o'clock tomorrow afternoon, and we will enjoy with you. And I promise you that we will let your save your kingdom. So she said, yes, we will come in our palanquins. Ah, very nice. So the next day, the Muslim army was so overjoyed that not they only won the battle, but they could enjoy all these women. They started drinking and partying. You know, they were like mostly drunk, waiting for the girl. And sure enough, at 5 o'clock, the gate opened, and hundreds of palanquins came out. And from the palanquin, you could cascade and you could see their saris, the girls' saris, and their robes, and, you know, and the Muslims, they were like, and they're watching, you know, standing there, drooling, as, you know, 350, 400 palanquins came out of the palace, being carried by young girls. And they came, and they made a circle in the center of the Muslim camp, and all the men, I want that one, I want that one. And all of a sudden, the queen, she blew the conch. And suddenly, out of the palanquins, each palanquin contained four male soldiers. You know, dressed in a sari. Red dot. They jumped out, took their sword, and massacred the Muslim army. They were outnumbered, I think, 6-1. But the Muslims were drunk and intoxicated enough, but they didn't have their weapons. And the queen, she's the only woman there. She was directing the fight. Now there, you go there. Now watch out. All over. They took the booty. They went back to the... So the girls also. So people were happy under the rule of such king and queens. And before, because of particularly the yogi's life was prosperous and people were encouraged for religious activity. So our modern politicians, they would do well to read the Bhagavatam, in particular these verses, study, apply these teachings, and the world would be happy. The formula is nothing new. Everything is there in the Bhagavatam to meet all our material and spiritual needs. It's not some theory, it's not some proposal. All demonstrated, in particular, millions of years ago by Lord Ramachandra, and documented here in the pages of Srimad Bhagavatam for all to see and understand. So we could have spoken Ram Leela, but I felt that this is a very practical verse to see how when the Lord comes, his instructions are very practical, and if we follow them, then we can live a happy, peaceful life, prosperous life, even in this modern day and age, if we apply these things. And tonight we'll speak some more Ram Leela. We'll speak Ram Leela at the lecture at 4:45 at Bhaktivedanta Manor. Jai Sri Ram, Sitaram Lakshman Hanuman Ki Jai, Dev Premanande. Thank you, Hare Krishna.